This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for checking us out today. Law and order. Donald Trump campaigned partly on that notion. Richard Nixon mentioned it when he accepted the Republican nomination back in 1968. And I'm sure the British wanted that from their unruly law-breaking colonists before they wrote that declaration and founded a new nation. Disorder, it seems, is relative. And law and order means nothing without justice. America's justice system still has many flaws. How do we fix them? Another phrase Nixon used might point the way. A phrase he said described how some African Americans view their place in society. A colony in a nation. Chris Hayes used that idea to frame his new book about racial inequity. He hosts the primetime news magazine All In on MSNBC. His new book is called A Colony in a Nation. Chris Hayes, welcome to 1A.
That's great to be here.
How'd the book come about?
The book came about because I was doing a lot of reporting on some of the protests around police conduct, police shootings particularly, growing out of the wake of Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, Freddie Gray's death in Baltimore, other places. And even before then, we've been doing a lot of reporting on my show on criminal justice. And I was thinking about writing about that and a little hesitant because it just seemed like the lived experience of folks that have been on the wrong end of the sort of racial and policing divide is something to which I don't have like subjective access. But at the same time, I also had this very intense experience of New York City in the 1980s and 90s, growing up in the Bronx, white kid, going into the city and the crime wave and all that meant. And what I came to kind of want to take on as the project of the book is to really kind of ask the question, not just what are the effects of the system we've built, but why did we build the system we built? Why did we, I say in the book, a majority of Americans vote to put a minority under lock and key? How did we bring through democratic means a system of policing and enforcement that to many people feels a lot like tyrannical, not democratic? So that's really the project of the book.
I read the book and I got the impression coming away from it that it might feel to some people like a revelation to really hear the details about this whole system. But to folk who look like me, it might feel like, we don't know where you've been all these years. We knew you could have just called your black friend.
Right.
And yeah. We could have told you all of this.
Yeah.
Who is this book for?
That's a great question. So, you know, I think any writer wants to be read by everyone, right? But I do think there's a degree to which the construction of the system we have is largely the embedded choices of white voters and a kind of political project that was done by white voters. And I think that it's important to introspect on what that was about and speak to people that are in that cohort. But I also think, frankly, that there's a degree to which the flip side of that, right? So there's the effect of it, but there's also the flip side of like, what is the appeal of that kind of call to law and order? And I think that has some deep stuff in everyone. I mean, I think there's actually universality in that. I think that as racialized as it is in the way that it's been implemented, the appeal of order, the appeal of keeping some set of people in one place so that you can be okay, the fear that comes with insecurity and crime, all those things are sort of profound and widely shared universal attributes, right? It's the ways that gets constructed and massaged and then weaponized through the process of American politics that produces the system we have.
I can imagine that a lot of white people might hear about a book like this and think, that's okay. I already know that I'm the problem in this country. I already know that everything racial that's wrong with America is my fault or my dad's fault or my granddad's fault or my great-granddad's fault. You don't need to tell me all over again. For people whose visceral first reaction to this idea is, I don't need to hear this again, what would you say to them?
I'm so glad you said that because I think a big part of what gets impacted in the sense of like a molar, right? Like that gets sort of bound up and knotted in a way that's unhelpful is this conception of guilt or defensiveness. Part of the project of the book and part of what I write about, I think honestly, is like we all feel, I as a white person living in New York City, you know, from a sort of working class outer borough family, worried about crime, being the victim of crime, getting my backpack jacked and my hat jacked and my bus pass jacked and all of that. You know, we all have a part of us that feels the siren call of the appeals that have created the system we have. And that feeling that is okay, right? Like the point isn't to put people in some sort of defensive stance about it's your fault. You should feel guilty. You are responsible for this. The point is to actually take the way that we feel emotionally and the way that politics cultivates those feelings and channels them in certain ways, and to kind of interrogate it, to take it and put it in different contexts, to think about the person who might be a perpetrator of a crime as someone we love, the person who might be an addict and a perpetrator of a crime, not as some other person you might encounter in the street, but actually as kin to you, to go through all the steps of taking the emotional content of how we talk about crime, law, and order, and interrogating it without getting defensive about that.
So it's okay to feel what you're feeling.
Of course it is. Right. Look, it's fine to feel. Part of the point of the book, and there's a long riff in there that works on uses some of the great work by James Foreman, who's got a book out called Locking Up Our Own, is that like no one wants to be the victim of crime. No one wants to live in places of high levels of violence. There are people that are fleeing Central America because the homicide rates there are so out of control and risking their life and limb to make the trek across Mexico for it. It is, I think, it's okay to say it's a universal concern of all people in all places to be safe and secure, to have their home and hearth protected, to have their kin looked after, that the worries about a criminal element can apply in all different kinds of societies across different kind of racial and tribal lines, and that people that feel that very kind of brainstem
That lizard brain thing.
Yeah. That is an okay thing to feel. We all feel it and it gets activated in different ways. And you don't have to get defensive about feeling that, and you don't have to get defensive about wanting security and safety, but to think about how that feeling gets turned into politics and policy.
We're talking to journalist Chris Hayes of MSNBC, the host of the news magazine All In with Chris Hayes, about his new book, A Colony in a Nation. Let's unpack that and set the scene. What is the nation and what is the colony and how do they intersect?
Right. So I think that one way to think about what happened in America post in beginning in the late 1960s is that the beginning of the dismantling of de jure segregation, Jim Crow.
Segregation by law.
Right, yeah. Segregation by law led to a sort of new regime that was erected in the wake of it, right? And at the same time that transition was happening, there's a huge crime wave in America. Northern migration continues apace, and this sort of law and order incarceration regime starts happening too. And what you end up with is a society that basically gives up on desegregation as a goal. I mean, I think about this all the time. It's 2017. When's the last time you heard a politician or anyone in a policy discussion use the word desegregation? Like, it would be bizarre and antiquated. I am running on a platform of desegregation. We should think about desegregation. No one talks about desegregation.
It would feel a little strange.
It would feel strange. The fact of the matter is, as an empirical matter, schools are segregated, remarkably segregated, if not quite as bad as they were in 54 during Brown. At very high levels. We have very high levels of residential segregation. But what came in its stead after the dismantling of Jim Crow was the enforcement of a certain regime, both through realtor practices and zoning and fundamentally policing, that created these sort of warrens, the colony, that were going to be subjected to a certain regime of justice, that were going to be areas of concentrated poverty and law enforcement that were largely black and brown, although I think there's a complicated way in which that's changing over time. And the nation is the place in which all of the kind of procedural protections we expect from the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, the place where you can smile at a cop and he pats the head of your toddler and helps the old lady cross the street, in which that relationship between the criminal justice system is invisible, right? I mean, huge swaths of America have no interaction with the criminal justice system every day. And huge swaths of America, it is just a constant thrumming presence in their lives. And to me, that's the biggest division.
One of the places where you described your experiences with the nation and kind of your realization of being a firmly planted resident of the nation was when you attended the Republican National Convention in the year 2000 in Philadelphia with a little bit of weed.
Just a little.
In your pocket. Let's be clear.
In my eyeglass case.
Yes, Chris Hayes is not all squeaky clean. But you skated. Like, they didn't dump you for it. They kind of were like, okay, kid, get out of here. They basically let you off with not even a warning.
Not even a warning. And I think, to me, it crystallized a few things. One is the decision the police officer made in that context when he's essentially standing guard at the Republican convention is he is charged with the task of public safety. And he made a decision that I was not a threat to that, which was the correct decision. Like, he's trying to make sure that nothing bad goes down in a violent sense, right? There's no threat to anyone inside the convention center, and he made a judgment that this wasn't a threat, and he was correct. That could be more broadly applied.
But couldn't he have made that decision with someone who was not white who was under the same circumstances? Couldn't it have been me?
It's possible. You know, it is possible, right? Like, I can't run the counterfactual. I think that it's hard to separate my race from that, but I think it's also possible he would have made that decision, right? Because of what his mission was in that moment. Although that gets to the sort of deeper point, which is like, what do we want the police to do? We want them to protect public safety, not necessarily to enforce some set of social taboos or some kind of social order. But the other thing about that moment to me that is so important, and this is something that I did a lot of interviews with police over the last 2 or 3 years, 4 years. You know, the latitude a police officer has in the moment on the street is remarkable. The authority they have is remarkable. And in some ways, cops will tell you it has to be that way for them to do their job because every situation is different and unique. You come upon a fight between two people that you have to resolve. You have a unique and different set of facts every time that you're walking into a situation. You have to make snap decisions on the ground as the frontline representative of the state's authority. And you have to have the ability to grant latitude in some cases or not in others. But it's also that ability to grant latitude that can be the source of so much disparity and injustice.
And I do want to talk more about the disparity, the injustice, and what we do about it when we come back on the other side of this break. We are speaking with MSNBC host Chris Hayes about his new book, A Colony in a Nation. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're spending the hour with Chris Hayes, the host of the MSNBC news magazine All In with Chris Hayes, and the author of the new book, A Colony in a Nation. Let's go deeper into this idea of policing and the unjust way that policing is enacted in the colony, as you describe it, and in the nation. There's been a lot of conversation about certain police tactics like stop and frisk or broken windows policing. Talk about the sprawling prison system in the United States. And you highlight that Richard Nixon speech that we mentioned earlier, the 1968 address at the RNC. The speech contained a call for order that, in your words, as you see it, justified all this escalating incarceration. Here's a piece of what Richard Nixon said that day.
The American Revolution was and is dedicated to progress, but our founders recognized that the first requisite of progress is order. Now, there is no quarrel between progress and order, because neither can exist without the other. So let us have order in America, not the order that suppresses dissent and discourages change, but the order which guarantees the right to dissent and provides the basis for peaceful change. Let those who have the responsibility to enforce our laws and our judges who have the responsibility to interpret them be dedicated to the great principles of civil rights, but let them also recognize that the first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence, and that right must be guaranteed in this country.
That was Richard Nixon speaking at the 1968 Republican National Convention on Miami Beach. The first requisite of progress is order. Based on what you write in your new book, that's not true. That's not really what the founding fathers thought at all. What really happened?
Well, it's a sort of remarkable passage. It's remarkable for a few reasons. One, it's interesting to hear the kind of needle threading that Nixon's doing in that moment on the one hand, on the other, which is a rhetorical mode I think we associate now with Barack Obama, actually. But, you know, he is very finely calibrating this appeal, right? I understand that people are upset about this, and yet, in terms of going back to the revolutionary generation to find in them a kind of celebration of order, I mean, one of the projects in the second chapter is to reclaim the disorderliness of the revolution. The fact that mob violence, for instance, was a tool of the revolution, that customs officials who attempted to stop and frisk smugglers would be dragged by crowds through the streets and tarred and feathered. They would be beaten up. That local law enforcement couldn't get convictions against people charged with smuggling because of jury nullification. They would bring trials and the juries wouldn't let them go. That, in fact, the entire revolution in America was a reaction to the policing excesses of the British Crown in a very literal way that I think has been lost to history, that I attempt to reclaim in the book.
Although it's funny, if you read through the Declaration of Independence, and if you've never actually read through the Declaration of Independence, go read it. Google it. Read it. If you actually read through it, that's the whole declaration. It's a letter saying, "Dear King, we're busting out, and here's why." And they list all of these unjust things that you basically lay out in the book.
My favorite line in the Declaration of Independence, a line that, again, I had read it before but hadn't caught me, is, he has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. Swarms of officers to harass our people and eat out their substance. What he's talking about is a policing regime that is being imposed on the colonies, right? For the purpose of collecting taxes and revenue that is humiliating the colonists, who are generally running a huge gray market and black market hustle by smuggling in tons of goods. And it is that policing regime, what I call in the book the first version of stop and frisk, that escalates, it gets militarized. Benjamin Franklin talks about the fact when the crown brings in naval ships to start searching, right? He says, "Oh, this will work marvelously. Convert your sailors into tools of tyranny. This is ridiculous." He writes this sort of sarcastic, biting letter about it. It was very much a reaction to those excesses that drove the revolution in a sort of tip of the spear emotional way that I think you just cannot ignore.
You draw a connection in the book between some of the economically depressed, drug-infested neighborhoods of the U.S. today and the colonies. I mean, John Hancock, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence with the big fancy signature, was a smuggler.
He was a smuggler.
Right.
In fact, and it's not crazy. I mean, there's a few people, I think, who are going to hate this analogy, and I've already seen people rebel against it. Think for a second about the way the colonies operated, right? The British colonial system imposed tight restraints on what could and could not be imported because they wanted to take tariffs from all of the exchanges. And the colonial system was to expropriate.
That's how they made their wealth.
That's how they made their wealth. That's how they got money. But the colonists needed lots of things that couldn't be found in the British colonies. For instance, they needed molasses to run their distilleries. They just made a ton of rum. And they got the molasses from Dutch colonies. And so how did they get it? They smuggled it in. And it's not that different smuggling molasses than smuggling marijuana, particularly if you're smuggling molasses as the thing to make an intoxicant, rum or whiskey, right? That this was actually the economic engine of huge parts of the colonies, particularly the most rebellious quadrants, which were the port cities of New England, where the revolutionary violence really begins.
Well, but wait a minute. I can understand if someone hearing all this can't see the parallel, where they think, well, this is a colony that was under the control of a king, where these people were barely second-class citizens, and they threw off the shackles of tyranny to found a new nation with ideals and principles that would grow to be something noble. Not just people who are dealing drugs on a corner,
right,
getting little kids shot by gang members who can't aim,
right,
and just kind of bringing down the country. They're not the same thing.
So the important distinction there, right, is that the violence that attaches to the black market trading in drugs, in this case, didn't exist then for a number of reasons. But one of them is that for much of the period before the revolution, they just basically turned a blind eye to it. I mean, it was illegal technically, but it was sort of allowed to flourish. And yes, it is very different, you know, having, you know, shootouts and drug wars on corners and smuggling molasses. But the point is that in both cases, the state deems some good illicit, right? And it deems it illicit despite the fact that it is largely socially accepted and used, and then uses ever more draconian methods to attempt to stamp out its use.
You have a description in the book of the colony and the nation on page 37,
yep,
I believe it is. Would you read that piece? It starts with "in the colony," yep, and it ends with "it's not." This is a piece of a colony in a nation. Go ahead, Chris.
In the colony, violence looms, and failure to comply can be fatal. Sandra Bland, a 28-year-old black woman who died in a Texas prison cell in July 2015, was pulled over because she didn't signal a lane change. Walter Scott, the 50-year-old black man shot in the back 3 months earlier as he fled a North Charleston police officer, was pulled over because one of the three brake lights on his newly purchased car was out. Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old resident of one of Baltimore's poorest neighborhoods whose spinal cord was snapped in a police van, simply made eye contact with the police officer and started to move swiftly in the other direction. If you live in the nation, the criminal justice system functions like your laptop's operating system, quietly humming in the background, doing what it needs to do to allow you to be your most efficient functional self. In the colony, the system functions like a computer virus. It intrudes constantly. It interrupts your life at the most inconvenient times, and it does this as a matter of course. The disruption itself is normal. In the nation, there is law. In the colony, there is only a concern with order. In the nation, you have rights. In the colony, you have commands. In the nation, you are innocent until proven guilty. In the colony, you are born guilty. Police officers tasked with keeping these two realms separate intuitively grasp the contours of this divide. As one Baltimore police sergeant instructed his officers, do not treat criminals like citizens.
Pause right there. As you read through that, as you began to put these pieces together, what went through your head, what went through your heart when you started to see this and look at the country in a different way? Did it dawn on you? Was this just crystallizing something you'd been thinking about for a while? I mean, what does this do to look at the country and go, oh, that's what this is?
I think that I had thought of it. I think I had thought of racial disparity in the criminal justice system. I'd read Michelle Alexander's book. I have friends, many friends actually, who are public defenders who work in the system day in, day out. I have other friends who are prosecutors. I think that I hadn't quite, what I think snapped into focus in writing this book is the distance we've traveled from our basic democratic commitments to the routine grinding mercilessness of the system. That when you think about the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment and due process protections and all of that and the dignity of each of us as citizens in a free liberal democratic society, and then you go spend some time in an arraignment court where people are just being churned through, these two things don't look like they could possibly be part of the same system. The system as it actually functions every day, which is this sort of assembly line factory, and the system that believes in things like no unwarranted search and seizure and the right against self-incrimination and due process and trial by jury, it just doesn't seem possible that those exist in the same place. And they do geographically, but in some functional conceptual sense, they don't.
It's also interesting in the book the way that you lay out certain environments in which this idea of law and order and this need to keep strict order kind of is allowed to lapse a bit. I went to the University of Miami, which is a bit, hey, what is that laughter supposed to mean, Chris?
That laughter is you're about to go into what a party scene is like at the University of Miami on game day.
I have no idea what you're referring to. But really, I mean, you know, UM had a reputation as being this big party school. That's not why I went, but it does.
Right.
And I happened to be there the season we had that undefeated year in football. So I've seen what we can do. And you talk about your experiences on a college campus, and it's fun. You went to Brown.
I went to Brown, yeah.
And it's fun, and it's like, oh, yeah, college campus, Animal House, until you realize, like, oh, those colleges have law enforcement as well, and those colleges are crazy all the time.
Right.
As a matter of course, and the same thing doesn't happen.
That's exactly right. And there are, again, this to go back to your question about sort of drug dealers and the founders, right, there are differences between a neighborhood that has high levels of gun violence and a college campus, and there's reasons to police them differently. That said, the kind of forgiveness as a kind of default posture towards the excesses of adolescence that happens on a college campus is a model that has its own problems, but by and large, I think is a relatively proper approach to dealing with people that age. And one of the things I think I've come to believe through writing this book is that there's a sort of universality to the way you act out between 12 and 25. And depending on where you are and how much social capital you have and what enforcement your regime in, that acting out can mean that you're a criminal or that you're just acting out. And it can mean that you are someone who's going through a hard time and needs to see a therapist and get addiction counseling, or it can mean that you're a thief and a repeat offender and someone who doesn't show up to their parole hearing.
So where is the gap being bridged then between that system that allows for a little more discretion, a little more discernment in what someone's really dealing with, and today's criminal justice system? There are plenty of people in today's criminal justice system who could use a little discretion.
I mean, a huge, let's just be clear, a huge percentage of the people that are moving through the system are addicts or suffering from really intense mental illness. So just let's just talk about those people. And what percentage that is hard to, but, you know, I've seen a lot of addicts and I've seen a lot of people wrestle with mental illness in who have relatively high levels of social capital. And the resources that are brought to bear to deal with addiction or mental illness are amazing, and they can really help. We don't do that as a society. Right now, we're talking about cutting Medicaid. That would, in the midst of an opioid crisis that has now flowed the banks of the colony in a racial sense, has flooded huge swaths of white America, particularly sort of working class, working poor white America. We're talking about empathy, but operationally, are we going to do the things necessary to extend that kind of empathy? Are we going to do the things necessary? Are we going to treat an addict who is 24 years old in a part of the country with a median income of $20,000 a year? Are we going to bring the resources to bear for that person that that same addict would have at Brown University? I don't think the answer is yes.
You talk also in the book about this colony nation analogy in more of a geographic sense. You know, the colonies, the American colonies, were an ocean away from the British Empire. But this colony and a nation that your book is about, they basically kind of occupy the same space. They sit right next to one another or adjoining neighborhoods or one side of the train tracks and the other side of the train tracks. How do you think that affects the dynamic of one to the other in terms of recognizing each other's needs, making things more equitable? What does that kind of cramped relationship feel like? What does that do?
Yeah, I think that's a great question because I think my experience is growing up in the Bronx in the 1980s and 90s where it's all a patchwork. It's all on top of each other. And then going to school in the Upper East Side where the dividing line between East Harlem, which is relatively poor neighborhood and at that time had a very high crime rate, and the Upper East Side, which is one of the toniest neighborhoods, was just a block or two, right? I think what it does is it creates a desire for borders. It creates a desire for protection on the people who are on the safe, I'm putting air quotes in that, safe side of that line. And I think it drives a lot of the politics of fear that are at the core of who we've often been as a people, democratically speaking. I think that the desire to kind of the recognition that there's no escape, the kind of explosive ethnic and racial politics of New York City, where everything is cheek by jowl, it turns out that those are endlessly exportable, even to places where the distances are more extreme.
So is this fear? You know, we talked at the beginning of the program about what you're feeling is normal. It's human. It's nothing to be ashamed of. It seems like that may be also what makes this such an intractable issue, is that we are dealing with just a piece of, not necessarily evil, but a piece of human nature that's emotional and understandable.
That can be cultivated by demagogues in all kinds of awful ways, or can be addressed and channeled in ways that aren't awful. And, in America, we tend to be very focused on what we're doing here, but obviously there are police all over the world. There are ethnic and racial divisions all over the world in all sorts of different societies. And there is always the America has a particularly kind of violent history, a history that's always been shot through with this sort of fear of the other. So it's our particular inheritance from the moment that the first ship lands at Jamestown. And the captain writes in his diary, as a quote in the book, "We were set upon by the savages." The posture is like,
help,
kill or die.
Right.
Like, we have to conquer these people, or they're coming at us, or that's our land and we're going to take it. And the planter patriarch who's sleeping in a house in which he and his family are outnumbered by the slaves in the field by a ratio of 10 to 1, in the back of his mind is a slave revolt. That psychological inheritance in our politics is both universal, but also a particular American inheritance that has been passed down through the centuries.
Well, if there is a way to let that inheritance go, we should definitely talk about it on the other side of this break as we continue our conversation with MSNBC's Chris Hayes, the author of the new book, A Colony in a Nation. Stay close. Let's continue our conversation with MSNBC's Chris Hayes, the author of the new book, A Colony in a Nation. Before the break, we were talking about this inheritance that we have, how fear has driven a lot of these interactions that now show up in our culture and in law enforcement and so on. You work in cable news, which is not really an industry that is driven by hope and optimism. There's a lot of very scary kind of, even in the way that the cable news networks promoted the election, some of the debates, you know, Trump, Clinton, one night only. Yeah. It was just very, it was very HBO sports, you know, Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz, fight night. I mean, it was a little bit much. But it worked. The ratings went up, right, and the networks are making money hand over fist, and the nation responded to it. So I don't know where we begin to break the chain.
Right. That's a, it's a great point, because the fact of the matter is, because of that fear is located in that brainstem, in that deep fight or flight place, in that place that, that evolved the first of all the parts of our sort of neural architecture. That's the easiest part to reach. If you're trying to get clicks, if you're trying to get ratings, if you're trying to get votes, I mean, that is the place you go to because it is so electric. If you can grab that, and there has to be, so what happens often is that our media, particularly during the crime years, I mean, particularly during the crack years and the sort of peak crime years, I mean, the media used that, that plug into that brainstem, into that lizard brain to drive attention.
Do you count yourself among that?
I feel the temptation of it. I mean, it's different now because I don't think crime is treated in the same way, but I think with terrorism, it's it, there's a sort of analogy. I think that the way that we are disposed to cover terrorism is not that different from the way we were disposed to cover crime at a certain time. And neither of those things negates the fact that both crime during the peak crime years was horrifying, a massive wrenching social crisis and human tragedy that was truly terrifying, right? Which is the case about things like the Pulse nightclub shooting or San Bernardino or Paris, which are genuinely terrifying, horrifying, awful, evil acts, right? But the question of what do we choose to communicate about those? What do we try to trigger in the brain of someone when they think about that? There is always that incentive to reach for that kind of fear knob because it feels like that's going to grab attention the most.
You also talk about what you call in the book white fear. You write that it's more than fear in general that maintains the colony. And I'm quoting from the book, it is more than fear in general that maintains the colony. It's a very specific type of fear. I think I can kind of infer what you mean by white fear, but give me a specific example of how that specific kind of fear plays out concretely.
If you go all the way back to the conversation that was had after the Civil War, the conversation around, particularly in Reconstruction, particularly during the backlash to Reconstruction and Redemption, is about fear. It's about the fact that the black folks, will hurt us. They're, our people are going to be victims of their depredations. And if you walk your way through the entire literature of anti-immigrant rhetoric, lynching in the 1920s, 1960s, there is always this combination of the way that folks who are perceived as not white, sometimes as Irish folks, sometimes as black folks, are also perceived as dangerous. That there's a way of, that in the deepest part of our sort of social DNA as a society of that was run by white people and has a white majority this day is to associate non-whiteness and danger. And that shows up even in a laboratory setting in which you ask people to hit a button to identify threat or friend, right? So people pop up and they're either aiming a gun at you or carrying a bag of groceries. We see bias towards fear against non-white figures. And crucially, that is also embodied by black experimental subjects, which is to say it is our collective inheritance.
It's not just white people toward black people, for example. Black people express it toward one another.
Exactly.
It's in the culture.
That's exactly right. Now, there are different levels. Like, white people have elevated levels of it. But in experimental settings where you're sort of testing implicit bias, what you find is everyone has this implicit bias.
You also talk about an extension of this that has to do with losing out or missing out or having something that was yours taken away. And it seems like this might perhaps be getting more acute now because of what some people call the Browning of America, how we're becoming
Absolutely.
A majority-minority nation, and where you have people talking about the nation being taken from them. And this is something that is demographic, and it's inexorable. So it seems like this is a fear that's kind of, for some people, just doomed to be
existential.
There.
Existential.
Right, to get worse.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of ways in which that fear was the predicate for the election. The big question, and in some ways a question at the heart of this book, is it all zero sum? Is it a fixed pie? If you get a bigger slice, do I get a smaller one? The fear is yes. The fear is the colony needs to be kept in its place and away from me, because if it is not, I will be dragged down to that level. I will be less safe. I will be able to flourish less. I will be poorer. As opposed to the notion that actually it's not zero sum. There are net benefits to be gained by all if we move towards a society that was more equal, if we moved to a society that was less incarcerated, that spent less money on its criminal justice system, etc. That zero sum thinking is really deep in the human brain. And it can be very powerfully cultivated by political leaders who adhere to it. I mean, I think the president, one of his central ideological commitments that's even deeper than ideology, I think it's instinctual, is a notion of zero sum. A notion that if the Mexicans benefited from NAFTA, then we didn't. If you got the good part of the deal, I got the bad part of the deal. If you think in those terms, it is going to be very hard to make a case for genuine equality.
Does the election of Donald Trump signal to you that now maybe is not the best time for us to be able to fix this problem right now? Does this indicate something to you about the state of mind of maybe not even the whole electorate, but a significant chunk of the nation, that maybe this could be a tough nut to crack in 2017?
I think it can, but there's two reasons to be hopeful. One, in a perverse way, is not something to be hopeful about on its own, which is that economic decline and downward mobility has devastated huge swaths of areas that were formerly in the nation. It has both powered, I think, the kind of resentment politics that have driven Donald Trump, but it has also given an opening to talk about what a kind of shared better future would look like. I mean, I just did a town hall on the south side of Chicago, and then I did a town hall in McDowell County. McDowell County is the poorest county in West Virginia that was an almost entirely white audience, mostly white. South side of Chicago was mostly black, entirely black. And there's a lot of shared challenges for those two groups of people. There's a lot of shared struggles. And there's an opportunity because of the universality of that experience, even as we watch people losing loved ones to the opioid epidemic, to talk about what we share and talk about envisioning a society that got rid of those borders in which people could flourish collectively and together.
What are some of the things that you heard at both of them specifically?
In both places, the experience of decline.
Right.
Which was really interesting to me. Like on the south side of Chicago and in McDowell, when I said to them, have things gotten better since the financial crisis? They're like, no, they haven't gotten better. The experience of trauma. There was a lot of trauma and a lot of pain in both those rooms. When I asked people who'd lost someone to violence in that room in Southside, huge amount of people put their hands up. When I asked a room full of folks in West Virginia who'd lost someone to opioids, a huge amount put their hands up. There's a huge amount of untreated trauma in this country. There's a huge amount of pain, frankly, across these sort of racial lines. And people that have relative amounts of wealth, resources, social capital, and privilege find ways to deal with that that is pretty effective and adaptive. And for millions of our fellow citizens, that's not an option. And the kinds of cycles that then kick into gear in the absence of treating that are, you know, apparent everywhere.
So do we see a time at which the colonies begin to band together to throw off the nation? I mean, to carry the analogy forward?
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, right? Like, I think both that, I think there's a way in which the transformation of these sort of large swaths of white America can go in either direction, right? We're sort of on this nice edge. Can it be the fact that, like, you're sold a vision in which it is zero sum, they're taking a larger piece of the pie, and you need to fight and elect the person who's going to take it back for you, which is what a lot of the narrative of the election was, or that actually you share something with these people, that their experiences and your experiences are actually trending towards each other in this profound way, and that could be the basis of a new kind of politics.
If the colonies don't band together, to carry the metaphor forward, if people who have these shared experiences don't see their shared humanity, who benefits? Who is benefiting from this division right now?
There are a lot of politicians that benefit who have used the divisions to get themselves in power. There are part of the problem of dismantling the system we have is that there's millions of beneficiaries throughout it, right? So the entirety of the prison industrial complex, as it's called, has people that work for it. And it's hard to dismantle a prison, put people out of work in a place like upstate New York where there aren't many jobs.
Who's the easiest one to reach in terms of if I'm in the colony and I want to take action against this nation?
Right.
Who's my lowest hanging, easiest to reach target?
I'll tell you who. Your local district attorney.
The district attorney?
Yeah.
Why is that?
District attorneys are elected. District attorneys, state's attorneys. And Europeans, by the way, think this is insane. That it's bananas that you would have your prosecutors be elected. And I tend to think they're actually probably right. And what we have seen, and there's a lot of great empirical work on this. John Pfaff has a book called Locked In. He analyzes this. You know, they have prosecutors matter, and the latitude that they have matter a tremendous amount in how incarceration functions. And we have started to see people organize to elect, to vote out prosecutors that embody some of the worst policies of the system, and vote in people that are taking a fresh approach. And it's a struggle. Right now in Orlando, there's a district attorney who's the first black district attorney elected in Florida who said she was not going to ever use the death penalty. And the governor has stepped in to appoint a special prosecutor in the case of a police officer who was murdered. So it's an uphill battle. But it's a really concrete local place that people can get involved if they want to see a different system is in these low turnout elections for the local officials who have arguably the most power and latitude over this entire system are local prosecutors.
So what's the end game? No more colonies, all nation, a totally different paradigm altogether that doesn't have that dichotomy even implied? Like what's the super objective? What's the goal?
The super objective to me is to go back to the project of desegregation, which was an unfinished project, to put front and center the project as a social policy outcome by which we judge ourselves as a society of desegregation. And that as desegregation, decarceration, and collective flourishing among people, black, white, all races, as we sort of head towards this new demographic future. But we replaced at a certain point the notion of we replaced desegregation with the notion of diversity. We replaced desegregation with the kind of carceral containment that the colony gave us. And this is what we've ended up with. We have to go back to that as a model.
When you say we've replaced desegregation with the notion of diversity, do you mean the presence of diverse groups of people rather than the inclusion, the equity of
exactly,
diverse groups?
That's right. Exactly. Okay. So that, like, that is the social goal, is for society and institutions to be diverse as opposed to be desegregated. Those are different things, right? So I think it's really important, the actual divisions that are sort of shot through society, to go back at that. There's an amazing journalist named Nicole Hannah-Jones who's writing a book on this in the school context. She won a Peabody for this American Life piece called The Problem We All Live With. And I am increasingly of the belief that sort of returning to that original social purpose is really key.
Before we run out of time for the hour, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are listening who are thinking, well, that sounds all nice to you, Chris Hayes, with your show on MSNBC and all these theories in a book. I'm one white guy.
Yeah.
I'm one white woman. I don't know what you want me to do to lead this desegregation effort. Like, what do you want me to do? What do you want people to do?
I want people to think about, what do they want? I think when they think about politics and when they think about public action, when they think about voting for people, particularly in local elections, where a lot of these decisions get made, I want them to look into what the positions are of those elected leaders on things like incarceration and things like drug courts and things like police reviews of police practices and independent reviews and things like that. But more than anything, I mean, there are so many incredible writers, journalists, academics working in this space who have tons of great programmatic solutions. What I want people to do is interrogate the thing they feel when they feel the flush of blood to their face in the context of these issues, whether it's race or policing, and they're thinking about them in political terms, left, right, whatever your politics are, to take the second to figure out what's going on there when you feel your cheeks get flush.
Chris Hayes hosts the MSNBC show All In with Chris Hayes. His new book is called A Colony in a Nation. Chris, thanks for spending the hour with us.
Had a great time.
1A comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you for listening. This is 1A.